There was one reason for that, and it was that I had taken the time when things were good to prepare. I had no way of knowing that this was in our future. Even in my worst imaginings, this had never even made the list. Sure, I had thought of an EMP, but the totality of it didn't even come close to what I imagined. Not having transportation or water were things I thought of, but you really can't get a feeling for it until you're there. We had always had power and running water, and even during the worst hurricanes, we could go to town for some ice or other supplies we needed. Maybe the folks that lived through Katrina had a better idea of what it took, but I damn sure hadn't. I was surprised at how much was still on the supply shelves. Everything from canned food and toothpaste to lamp oil and feminine hygiene stuff. There was shampoo and soap, first aid stuff, rice and bags of beans, and lots more. I wondered where to start and what to take. For many years, I had been buying 10-pound bags of rice and beans and storing them in Mylar bags with oxygen absorbers, then placing the bags in 5-gallon buckets. There are a dozen buckets I can see, plus the ones under the bottom shelf. While not the most appetizing combination in the world, it will keep you alive. Thankfully, I thought to store a lot of salt as well. My pack was lying on the bench, and I went over to it and opened it up. I hadn't really messed with it since I had gotten home. There wasn't much left in it, just MREs, my mess kit, and my sleeping bag. I pulled the sleeping bag out to hang up and let it air out for a while, and I saw the envelope in the bottom of the pocket. I opened it and found a note and a thumb drive. I remembered Sarge had said something about putting it in there. He had asked if I had a computer. I had my old laptop in the shop, but the battery would need to be charged before I could use it. I was walking across the shop to get it when I heard the bell at the barricade. 3 rings, then 3 more. It caught me off guard. I was standing there, looking out the door of the shop, when the bell started to ring continuously. Running outside, I yelled at the girls to get in the house. I was still yelling at them and waving them toward the house when the first shot rang out. It started as a couple of pops, but it turned into a fusillade of continuous cracks. The girls ran for the back door, and I ran in behind them. Picking up my carbine, I headed for the door. Mel yelled at me. "Where are you going?" "To the barricade. You hear that? Get the M1 and stay inside," I shouted as I ran out the front door. The bell had stopped and the crackle of gunfire had slowed. I was running down the driveway when a figure ran in front of my gate, a man in dirty clothes. He had a short beard and wore a Ford hat on his head. He stopped and looked right at me. He was breathing hard and his eyes were huge. He held a rifle at his waist and turned toward me as he brought it to his shoulder. I dove to the ground and shouldered my AR while prone, and he fired before the rifle got to his shoulder. I brought the sights up and started to fire at him. My first couple of rounds missed, but the third hit him in the left thigh, and he spun in the road. He was sideways to me when I finally got a good sight picture and put 2 quick rounds in his ribs. He fell like a sack of meat. The sound of gunfire started to rise again. It sounded like it was coming from down the road, farther into the neighborhood. I slowly got to my feet and in a crouch moved toward the gate. The sound of guns going off and the crack of the rounds as they passed grew louder. As I got closer to the gate, I was able to see up the road a little. There were several people in the road, standing upright and firing at something. One of them was the guy who had talked to Danny and me at the gate when we gave the group heading into the forest water. He had a rifle to his shoulder and looked back and yelled at someone. I knelt on one knee and lined him up in the sights. 2 quick rounds, and he went down. In my peripheral vision, I caught some movement to my right and swung the carbine around. Mark was in a crouch, firing his carbine and moving toward the barricade. I moved to the gate and called to him. He didn't look up, so I checked the road and saw 2 men running for the barricade. One of them fell, and the second turned to shoot back, and was met with a hail of fire from Mark, me, and Rick, who was behind Mark. He went down just inside the barricade. The 3 of us spread out and started up the road, looking for anyone else. Once we made it to the barricade, Mark and Rick checked the road to see if there were any others out there. The road was empty of the living, but there was one body lying in it. With the area secure, we started to look for the two guys that should have been on the barricade. My gut tightened when I saw two bodies laying on the right side of the road. One of them was face down, his rifle lying under him. The other was laying back, his legs folded under him as if he had been on his knees when shot, and he fell back. From where I was, I could see the wound was to his face, and I didn't want to get closer to see who it was. Thad had about a 6-mile ride to the post office. He could have gone through the nearby neighborhood, but decided instead to go down 41 and straight into town. There were a couple of reasons for his decision. First, if he went through the neighborhoods, he ran a much higher risk of encountering people. A big black man on a bike, riding through a predominantly white neighborhood under the current circumstances, would surely not be warmly received. Second, he wanted to see what things looked like on the highway. If there was anything organized going on, it would be out there. Thad rode down to Pump Station Road, past the water treatment plant, and the smell coming from it was awful. Past the plant, he turned onto 10 Cent Road, and continued on it as it turned into Aaron Cutoff Road. At the split in the road, where Caliente Way went off to the right, Thad stayed on Aaron. That way wouldn't take him through the neighborhoods. Up ahead, he would pass the entry to a couple of the pre-planned communities Florida was notorious for. Approaching the first of these, he could see some men standing around the ornamental wall entry. When one of them noticed him coming, he slapped another man on the shoulder and pointed. They both went back just inside the entry to take cover behind a car that had been pushed up to block it. Thad moved to the opposite side of the road, away from them, and tried to look as casual as he could. He kept his eyes fixed on the road in front of him, using his peripheral vision to see what they were doing. He wasn't sure, but it looked like they were pointing rifles at him. Thad just kept on pedaling and passed them without incident. He passed three more little miracles of modern housing with names like Magnolia Point and Caliente Casita Village. These others were likewise manned, but no one made any trouble. After the last neighborhood, the post office was only a mile or so down the road. Thad stopped the bike on the far side of the ball field, across from the post office, where there was good tree cover. He took a canteen out of his pack and took a drink, then replaced it in the pack and took out a small pair of binos. After hanging the pack by a strap from the handlebars, he used the binos to glass the building across the street. There were several vehicles there, mail trucks and others. One thing that caught his eye was the flagpole. The U.S. flag that typically flew there was missing. In its place was a FEMA flag. Thad just shook his head as he went back to looking at the building. The driveway was blocked and manned. There was a Humvee sitting at the barricade and four armed men in black uniforms loitering about. The one thing Thad had was time. He sat down under the big oak with his canteen and waited. From time to time, he would raise the binos and take a look at the building, but most of the time, he just sat there. Late in the afternoon, a group of men came out the front door. Three were in postal uniforms and two in the black tactical-looking ones. Thad raised the binos and watched as they all fished packs of cigarettes out of various pockets and lit up. He chuckled to himself at the thought that even under the current circumstances, they still couldn't smoke in the building. His big head rocked back and forth with a big smile on his face at that thought, and then the smile faded, and he became rigid as a board. He would never forget the man's face, and there he was. Thad moved the binos away for a moment, then looked through them again. It was him, no doubt about it. He watched as the man walked over to one of the mail trucks parked in front of the building. He leaned in for a moment, then returned to his friends. Now Thad knew which truck was his as well. The men finished their smokes and went back inside. Thad lowered the glasses and sat there thinking. All he knew was where the guy was today. If he left, he wouldn't have any idea where he went tomorrow. It was late in the day, and Thad decided he would stay there for the night to see where the mailman headed in the morning. He had no sleeping bag, but he had enough hate running around through him to keep him warm no matter how cold it got. Thad pulled the pack down, pulled out an MRE, and ate it cold. The sun started to drop, and he hadn't seen anyone come back out, so he knew the man was still there. Thad watched as the security on the barricade changed, a new crew coming out to relieve the ones on duty. Those being relieved went into the building. They must be staying in there, Thad thought. That's good. Thad pulled the pack over, made a sort of pillow out of it, and leaned back to try and get some rest. He had just closed his eyes when a bright light caused him to open them again. There was one of those diesel-powered light towers in the parking lot, lighting up the area. He hadn't noticed it before, and couldn't imagine how he hadn't seen it. It lit the surrounding area with a bright white light. He was sitting under and behind the oak trees, and his spot didn't light up too much. He spent the rest of the night listening to the hum of the diesel engine. He slept little. At 6 in the morning, he was pissing on the back side of the big oak when the light tower shut down. He looked up and saw a few people out in the parking lot. He picked up the binos again and started to watch the mail truck. He alternated between it and the front door, just waiting for the son of a bitch to come out. He didn't have to wait long. Around 7:30, he saw the face he was looking for. The man came out and lit another smoke, and as he did, Thad wondered if the lighter he used was the one that had started the fire. When it looked like they were getting ready to leave, Thad put his pack on and readied his bike. He waited as the mailman and his security escort got in the truck and pulled toward the barricade. The security personnel manning the barricade opened it so the truck could pull out. It was the first of several. The truck turned north on the highway. The next two turned south, and the last one turned north as well. After they were all out, Thad hung the binos around his neck and started to ride along the left field fence, parallel to the road. At the end of the park, he pulled out onto the sidewalk and kept his eyes on the lead truck, pedaling as hard as he could. At the intersection of Aaron Cutoff, the lead truck made a right, and the second one kept going north. Thad pushed himself to go faster. He angled the bike across the road toward the intersection, and making the turn, he saw the truck up ahead, just as it rounded a curve in the road. As Thad reached the curve, the truck was nowhere in sight, but he kept up the pursuit. As he approached the entrance of the neighborhood on the right, Thad called out to the men manning the barricade. "Did a mail truck come through here?" From behind the car, a man stood up and pointed down the road. From there, the options were pretty limited. They had to be going back out to Pump Station Road. He knew he couldn't catch the truck, but now he hoped he knew where it would be sometime later today. With that thought in mind, he began to ride at a more manageable pace. Turning onto Pump Station Road, Thad looked at the little dusting of sand where the road curved away from the plant. He skidded to a stop when he noticed his bike tire tracks in the sand had been cut by the larger tires of what Thad knew was a mail truck. Back at his truck, he took a minute to drain a canteen, then several to eat everything left in his pack. After eating everything he could find, including the sugar packets from the MREs, Thad pulled the truck up to the end of the dirt road and inside the tree line, enough that it wouldn't be seen. To pass the time, he went through the glove box, messed around with every knob on the dash, and when he was out of things to turn, twist, or flip, he pulled the pack over. He found a pack of apple jelly, tore the top off, and sucked its contents out. Reaching back in the pack, his hand landed on the transformer. He had it sitting in his lap when he finally opened his eyes to look at it. He remembered Tony lying in the living room floor playing with it. He held it up, making it walk along the top of the steering wheel. A slight smile came to his face as he made laser sounds, just like little Tony had. The smile faded, and Thad shoved the toy back in the pack. He had spent the day sitting in the truck, getting out occasionally to take a piss and stretch, and he was standing in front of the truck looking down the road when the mail truck rounded the corner onto Pump Station Road. Thad climbed behind the wheel, started the truck, and put it in gear. He watched up the road, waiting for the truck to come into view. It didn't take long. The The mailman was on the left, on Thad's side of the truck. Through the windshield, he could see the security man sitting beside the driver. As the truck came closer, he held the brake down and stomped the gas pedal to the floor. When the Jeep was almost in front of him, Thad let off the brake, and the truck leapt forward. He could see the driver as he raced toward it. He was looking over at the security man, who was looking out the windshield, and just before the truck slammed into the Jeep, the driver looked over. His eyes went wide, and his mouth opened in a scream that never made it past his lips. The truck hit the Jeep square in the driver's door. The two men were thrown to the far side of the Jeep. Thad kept the accelerator to the floor and pushed the Jeep to the opposite side of the road. The road was raised about a foot and a half, and as the Jeep's wheels dropped off its edge, it fell over onto its side. Thad didn't let off the gas and pushed the Jeep around so that the rear of it faced the road with the bottom of the Jeep pressed against the passenger side of the truck. He jumped out of the truck and ran to the front of the Jeep. The windshield was shattered, but still in place, and through it, he could see some movement. Raising one of his size 13 boots, Thad kicked the glass in with one thrust. The glass fell in on the mailman, who was trying to get up. Thad reached in and grabbed the man by the collar of his coat and snatched him out through the hole. The postal worker looked up, sudden recognition on his face, and said, "No!" Thad released the collar and wrapped his left hand around the back of the man's head, like an NBA star palming a basketball. His right hand was in a tight fist, and Thad smashed the man's face with a slapping, crunching sound. The body went limp. Thad turned his attention to the security man, who was trying to crawl out of the Jeep. Seeing Thad's feet, he looked up, blood streaming from his nose and mouth. Thad's right leg came forward. His boot crashed into the man's chin, snapping his head back, and he too went limp and fell half out of the Jeep. Chapter 18. Sergeant Mike double-timed it back to the shack. Rushing inside, Sarge yelled for Ted to get the claymores. Ted looked up from the radios he was monitoring and asked, "Why? You been followed?" Sarge set the M1A down, leaning it by the door where the weapons were kept. "No, we're going to ambush them again." He picked up the mini-me. Mike said, "They'll be expecting us next time." Sarge put the sling of the machine gun over his head. "Correct, but they think we're on this side of the river, and we're going to be on the other side, above them on the bank. Now hurry the fuck up." Sarge looked at Ted and said, "Get the saw, Mike. Grab one of the AT-4s. Doc, you're going to take us to the other side of the river, then come back into the canal here and wait. Take the 203 with you. If we get in trouble, start dropping some heat on them." Sarge saw the younger men thought it was a bad idea, but they did as they were told. Soon Doc was in the boat, and all the men climbed in. Sarge directed Doc to a point upriver from their last ambush. When they hit the bank, the three men jumped out. Sarge said, "Listen to the radio. I'll call you when we're ready to be picked up. Stay far enough back in there that no one sees you." Doc nodded and backed the boat back into the river, looking downriver for any sign of their targets. Sarge directed the guys to the high bank, overlooking the now two bodies in the river. He pointed out the locations for the three claymores they brought and indicated the positions he wanted the guys in. Each of them would have a clacker for setting off a claymore. They would be spread out on the ridge about 30 yards apart. Sergeant Ted would be at either end of the ambush, each of them with a saw, and Mike would be in the center with his carbine and the AT-4. Sarge instructed them that he would set off the ambush. If there was a security boat that stayed out in the river, Mike was to hit it with the rocket if the ambush was triggered. It was getting late in the day, and Sarge had begun to wonder if anyone would make it back that day when he heard the helo. Looking over his shoulder down the ridge, he could see Mike had his index finger above his head, twirling it around. Sarge nodded and put his hand out, moving it up and down slowly, telling Mike to chill out. Sarge looked downstream, and the Hilo shot right over his head, coming from behind him and going out across the river.
Shit,
Sarge muttered under his breath. He watched as the bird banked hard and turned on a bright spotlight. It was searching the side of the river where they had set the previous ambush. The pilot was making fast passes up and down the bank, dangerously close to Doc in the little canal. If they spotted Doc in the boat, they'd be fucked. The Hilo made another fast pass, the door gunner leaning out of the ship, a saw held to his shoulder, looking down into the swamp. On the next pass, the gunner pointed down into the swamp and talked into his headset. Mike pointed out at the Hilo and held his hands up in a WTF. Sarge shook his head, holding his fist up and shaking it at him, telling him to hold fast. Again, the Hilo returned to the mouth of the little creek. Sarge watched as the gunner stepped out onto the skid. He had to be looking at the boat Doc was in. The gunner looked toward the pilot and started to talk into his mic. Suddenly, three boats came roaring down the river, two fiberglass boats and one rigid hull inflatable, or RIB. The RIB was orange and had USCG painted on the side and the crest of the Coast Guard on the aluminum wheelhouse of the boat. Mounted to a hard point on the bow of the boat was a 50-caliber Browning machine gun. Sarge knew the ambush had been a mistake, but they still had the advantages of position and surprise. That didn't make up for the other side's air cover, but it helped. Between the three boats, there were more than 20 men. The boats went to the other side of the river, moving toward the creek mouth. Sarge dropped his head.
Motherfucker,
he said into the grass under him. He cradled the machine gun in his arms and crawled toward Mike, and then waved at Ted to come over.
What the fuck are we gonna do now?
I told you this was a bad idea, Mike said.
I know, but we're over here, and they don't know it, Sarge said.
Ted made it to them and said,
What the fuck, man?
Sarge cut him off.
Don't tell me it was a bad idea. I got that already. The question is, what are we gonna do about it? We can't leave Doc over there alone.
You're damn right we aren't leaving Doc over there. We got to draw those bastards off him, and then we got to try and get the fuck out of here, Ted said.
Ideas?
Sarge asked. Ted looked at Mike.
Can you hit that bird with the rocket?
Oh, sure. Just as soon as it goes into a hover and gives me the go signal.
Fuck no, I can't hit the damn thing.
Then what the fuck are we gonna do?
Ted asked.
Knock it off, damn it. Ted, you go back to your position. I'll go to mine. We're gonna open up on the bird. Mike, you hit that RIB. We put enough rounds on that ship, they'll bug out. Maybe we can even knock it down. As soon as it's gone, Ted, you and I open up on the other two boats.
Sarge paused and looked at Mike.
You have to get that boat. If they get that 50 into action, we're fucked to the max. Got it?
The two men nodded. Sarge said,
Let's get Doc's ass out of there.
With that, he crawled back to his position, and Ted did likewise. After settling back into his hide, Sarge looked down to Mike, who gave the old man a thumbs up and shouldered the rocket. Sarge set out another drum for the shortened saw and sighted down the barrel at the Hilo, which was now making slow orbits over the mouth of the creek. As the bird came out into the river, closer to them, and with the gunner on their side, he took a deep breath and settled his sight on the gunner, hanging out the door. He squeezed the trigger, and the little machine gun started to spew lead and tracers at the ship. Ted's gun joined Sarge's, and the gunner was hit numerous times. Sarge immediately changed his point of aim to just in front of the engine cowling, and, at the same moment, the ship banked hard and started to climb. A loud bang and a whoosh erupted from Sarge's left, and through his peripheral vision, he saw the rocket streak out across the river. The orange RIB erupted in a violent explosion. The other two boats immediately opened their throttles. One of them was too close to the bank and launched itself up onto the knees of the cypress trees on the side of the river. Ted and Sarge were both still firing at the ship as it raced to get out of range. Sarge could clearly see tracers from both his and Ted's weapon sink into the fuselage of the retreating Hilo. The last boat had moved upriver and was now putting rounds into the bank Sarge's tracers were coming from. The stranded boat exploded, and the few men that hadn't been on it turned and started firing into the swamp. Ted opened up on them, and another explosion went off in the tree line. The man he was shooting at went down. Sarge ran out of ammo and had to change belts. The men on the last boat were getting a better range on him, and their fire intensified. The boat started to move slowly back toward them. Mike and Ted both were looking for any signs of life on the other side of the river when a geyser of water erupted beside the boat. Mike looked upriver and began to fire at it with his carbine. Sarge was just closing the feed tray cover when another geyser of water erupted. The boat turned and started upriver, throttle wide open. Mike continued to fire at it until it rounded a bend out of sight. The RIB was gone, and the other boat that had got hung up on the cypress knees was burning, thick black smoke billowing up from it. The sound of an outboard revving up brought Sarge back around, and he looked across the river just as his boat came flying out of the creek mouth. Doc came across the river hard and fast, running up onto the soft mud just down from their location.
"Come on, come on!" Doc shouted.
Ted and Mike came at a run. Sarge asked,
"Did you get the claymores?"
"We got ours.
Head to the boat and I'll get yours," Ted shouted.
Sarge picked up the clacker and pulled the wire out. He picked up his saw and pack and ran for the boat. Mike was already down on the bank, and Doc had his weapon up and was looking upriver. Sarge jumped into the boat, and Ted was soon behind him. Mike was the last on board, and Doc backed the boat into the river and opened the throttle as he raced across the river toward the creek.
"This one's still alive,"
Rick called out from the road. He was standing over the body lying in the road in a spreading pool of blood. I looked at the two bodies lying inside our barricade. I could see them both lying there, but I couldn't see their faces, and I really didn't want to look at them. I looked up and saw Mark kneeling down beside the man on the road. I walked over toward the bodies. The one on his back, with his knees bent, was Lance. His arms were wide out to his side, as if he were making sand angels on the side of the road. Seeing him there with a bullet hole just above his right eye really hit me. I hadn't seen anyone I knew and cared for killed, and it landed on me like a ton of bricks. I walked over to the second form just behind the log barricade. He was on his side, facing away from me, but without seeing his face, I could tell was a smallish young man, and then I knew who it was. Reggie's nephew had moved in with him a week or so before, and, not wanting to feel like a mooch, he had been taking his turn on the barricade. As a reward for his efforts, he got a bullet in his chest. I went over to him and turned him over. His mouth hung open in a silent scream. His left eye was open and his right closed. I reached down and closed his eye. I sat there and wept over his body. I couldn't control it. It just came out. My hand was still on his face when I finally managed to get my shit together. I looked up to see Danny, Reggie, and a couple of others heading our way. Danny was on his ATV, and Reggie was at a full run. I looked over at Mark, who was still kneeling over the man on the road. Rick was covering him, his head constantly scanning the area. Danny skidded to a stop and hopped off the Polaris.
"What happened?"
"We got hit. Don't know what they wanted exactly, but you see what happened."
Reggie was almost to us, and I went out to meet him, to stop him. At my approach, Reggie slowed, huffing to get a breath.
"What the fuck happened?"
I shook my head. I didn't know how to break it to him. Reggie looked me square in the eye and simply said,
"Robbie?"
"Yeah, man. I'm really sorry."
Reggie walked over to the boy's body. Danny was standing there looking at him as Reggie came up. The big man stood there looking down in silence. Rick walked over to us and looked at the bodies, then looked at the three of us.
"It's the same group that came by a few days back, the ones heading into the forest. They were hungry and desperate, and they thought they'd come back here and scare us into giving them some food.
Without looking up, Reggie asked, "Did any of them get away?"
"Yeah. He doesn't know how many, though."
Reggie looked out at the road.
"He's still alive?"
Rick looked up at Reggie, oblivious to what was coming.
"Yeah. Mark's trying to find out where their camp is."
Reggie started out toward the road. Mark was still there by the man, who was now only barely alive. Reggie stopped by Mark's side and looked down at the stricken man on the pavement.
"You get what you needed from him?"
Mark looked up.
"Yeah, I got a pretty good idea of where they are."
"Looks like he needs a bandage," Reggie said. He knelt and pulled his Buck 110 from its sheath and rammed it into the man's chest. The wounded man couldn't even muster a scream. His mouth opened. He raised his head from the road, the veins on his neck bulging with the little blood still in him. Reggie twisted the knife, and the man twitched with every rotation of the blade. The dying man looked at Reggie as he let out his last breath, and as his head fell to the road, Reggie said, "That's for the boy," before pulling the blade out, wiping the blood on the tattered shirt before standing to sheath the blade. Mark sat on the road, looking up at Reggie. He rose, his eyes locked on Reggie. The big man just stood there, looking at the deputy as he stood. Mark raised his carbine and pointed it at Reggie.
"What the fuck is wrong with you damn people?" he screamed.
Reggie didn't reply. He just looked back at him. Mark flipped the safety off his carbine and demanded,
"Why? Why did you do that?"
"He was responsible for Robbie. He earned it."
"We can't just kill everyone we come across," Mark shouted,
the carbine still pointed at Reggie. I took a step toward Mark.
"Lower the rifle, man."
"No. We can't keep doing this. You fucking people can't keep killing people whenever you want."
"He killed two of ours. What were you going to do with him, put him in jail?" I asked.
Mark kept the rifle trained on Reggie.
"He was already dying. I was just going to let him die on his own. Now put your fucking hands up, Reggie."
"Take it easy, Mark. Chill out," I said.
"Shut the fuck up, Morgan. Get on the ground, Reggie," Mark shouted.
I raised my carbine, pointing it at Mark.
"Mark, you need to chill the fuck out."
Mark cut his eyes toward me, but before he could speak, I said,
"Mark, lower the weapon. You're out of line.
They killed his nephew. His niece is already dead. What the fuck do you expect him to do? They killed two of ours. What the fuck do you care how he died anyway?" Danny ran out into the road.
"What the hell is wrong with you guys? Mark, you're pointing a rifle at Reggie. Morgan, you're pointing a damn rifle at Mark. You guys are all going to start shooting one another now? We need to work together. This is bullshit. Put the damn guns down."
Mark and I both glanced at Danny, and I lowered my rifle.
"He's right, Mark. Put the rifle down."
Reggie looked at Mark and said,
"Shoot me if you're going to. Otherwise, get that shit out of my face."
He stepped past Mark and walked toward the barricade, passing Danny in the road. Reggie gave him a little nod and asked,
"Can you take him to the house for me?"
"Sure. Let's load him up." I gave them a wave and headed down the road toward my house. From behind me, I heard Mark call out,
"Who's going to man the barricade?"
I turned in the road.
"You are.
I'm going to Lance's house to tell his wife he isn't coming home for dinner. Get one of those guys to tell your wife you're okay." Turning around, I headed for the house. As I passed the man in the road that I shot while in the driveway, I paused and knelt down. He was dead, way dead. The two rounds I put in him did the job. He had bled out on the road. I patted his chest and then his pants. In his right pants pocket, I found 5 30-30 rounds, and in his back pocket was a wallet. The wallet contained what it probably had on the day things had fallen apart. There were 3 $1 bills, a Blockbuster card, and a driver's license with the name Clint Arnold. There was also a picture of him, his wife, and kids. The woman looked vaguely like one of the women who had come up to get water from the keg the day they came by. I could only imagine the desperation he must have felt to attempt this. I could see his wife and kids huddled under a thatch of palmettos with a small smoky fire in front of them. And now, he would never come back to them. I could just see my girl sitting there. Mel, dirty, hungry, and cold. And I vowed it would never happen. Not as long as I was alive. Tossing the wallet on his chest, I stood up and started to the house to get to the Suburban to go back and pick up Lance's body to take home to his wife. Mel met me in the driveway as I came up. "You okay?" she asked. "Yeah, but Lance and Reggie's nephew were killed."
"What happened?"
"They were a group that came through a few days ago. They had some women and kids with them, so we gave them water and talked to them a little. They seemed okay, but they were heading into the forest. I had a feeling they wouldn't make it, and they didn't. They ran out of food, and they thought they would come back here. Mark found one of them still alive, and he said they thought they would scare us, get some food from us."
"Did you shoot any of them?"
I nodded. "One for sure, and I may have hit another, but everyone was shooting at him. The one I shot is lying out there on the road in front of the house. I looked in his wallet, and he has pictures of his family in it. You know, Mom and Dad and the kids all together. He was just trying to feed his family."
"We can't feed everyone. The girls come first." Mel crossed her arms.
"If people want to come and try to take what we have, make our kids go hungry, then they need to pay the price."
"You're right. And they did.
But think about it this way. If we didn't have what little we do, then I might be faced with trying the same thing they did."
"But you planned ahead. We sacrificed for a long time to prepare for this, and I'm not about to give it away to anyone."
I looked at her with a little half smile. "Yeah, we sacrificed all right, and you bitched the whole time, as I recall."
She pressed her lips together, lowered her chin, and looked up at me. It was her, "You're an asshole" look, and I knew it well.
"What are you doing now?"
"I'm going to take the truck and get Lance's body. Take him home to his wife. Thank God they don't have any kids."
"Be careful," she said, as she turned and headed for the house. I went back to the shop and opened one of the cans of loose rounds I had bought from the Palmetto Armory. I topped off the mag, and I saw I had fired 12 rounds. I started thinking about the whole thing for a minute. I remembered firing at the first guy, but I didn't remember how many, and I hardly remembered the rest of it. They had invented that camera technique called bullet time for the Matrix films, the one that made everything super slow motion. But my bullet time was the opposite. Everything was too fast, and the details were all jumbled together. I knew I had to take Lance home, but I took a few minutes to clean and field strip my rifle. It was kind of cathartic, sitting on a stool, scraping the carbon out of the chamber of the Bushmaster.
"What you doing, Daddy?"
I looked over my shoulder to see Little Bit standing in the door. "Cleaning my rifle. What are you doing?"
"I'm bored. Leanne and Taylor won't play with me."
"I'm sorry, baby. I'll talk to them," I responded, as he ran a chamber brush into the rifle without looking up. She came into the shop and looked into the open ammo can. She knelt down and reached into the can and grabbed a fistful of rounds.
"These are big bullets, Daddy. The ones for my cricket are a lot smaller."
I slid the bolt carrier back into the upper. I looked over at her. "Yeah, they're a little bigger," I said with a smile, then closed the upper onto the lower and snapped the pin back in. With the carbine back together, I slid the mag back in and pulled the charging handle back to chamber around. Putting the rifle on safe, I told Little Bit, "Let's put these away, okay?" She stood up, and I closed the can, securing the lid with the latch. She said she wanted to put it away, so I moved back so she could try and pick it up. With a grunt, she grabbed the handle and pulled, but it didn't budge. She stepped over it with one foot on either side and grabbed it with both hands, and again, with a groan, she strained against the can. This time, it actually came off the floor a little. She dropped it back to the floor and hung her tongue out of her mouth. With wide eyes, she looked at me and said, "That's heavy." I smiled at her, and she cracked up. "Sure is." I pushed the can back into its place under the shelves. I went over to the other side of the shop
and grabbed a roll of clear plastic off one of the shelves. As I turned to head for the door, Little Bit asked if she could go with me. I wanted to take her. I liked hanging out with my girls, but this wasn't something for her to see. Sorry, baby. You can't come with me for this. She said, why not? I decided to tell her the truth. Because I'm going to get a man that was killed earlier. He's dead, and I'm going to take him home to his wife. She stood there for a minute. She asked, it isn't Danny, is it? Oh, no, baby. Danny's fine. It's not him. She stood there for another minute. I want to come. I want to help. She sure looked determined, and I thought maybe I should let her see it. She'd never seen a dead body before, and maybe she needed to. Okay, Little Bit. If you want to come, you can. But remember what I said I'm going to do. It isn't going to be fun. I know, but I'm going. Let me get my stuff. Hurry up. I'll meet you at the truck. She took off at a run and disappeared into the house. God only knew what she was going to get. Chapter 19. Chuck started to come around. His head was pounding, and his face hurt like hell, and his DHS uniform had blood on it. His vision was blurry, but he was able to make out Marty tied to a chair beside him. It looked as if he was in a barn of some sort, but he couldn't see much other than the metal siding and all the crap scattered around. He tried to pull his arms up, but they were tied tight, and there was no way he could get them out. His legs were likewise tied, and he couldn't even move his feet. Outside the barn, he could hear some animal noises. He hoped they were animals. Thad had never really thought the whole thing through. His plan only went so far as to try and get the men responsible for the death of Anita and little Tony. But now he had them, and he wasn't sure what to do. Like he did every evening, Thad had put a couple of scoops of the dwindling feed into a bucket. He went out behind the barn and thumped the side of the bucket with his hand while shaking the feed. It wasn't long before the 8 hogs he had turned out to forage came running toward him. He fed them every night. No sense in wasting the hog feed. As the hogs came trotting up, Thad looked back at the pen behind him and the big old oak in the center of the pen. He swung the gate open and walked into the pen. The hogs dutifully trotted in behind him. Thad dumped the feed into the trough and went out the gate, closing it behind him. He turned and looked at the old tree again, then back at the hogs, who were noisily consuming the feed he had dumped. He had an idea. Chuck looked up when he heard the door open and a big black man came in, leaving the door open. He was still having a hard time seeing. His broken nose and all the blood on his face added to the hangover effects he felt from whatever happened earlier. The black man walked past him, not even indicating he saw him.
Hey, what the fuck do you think you're doing? You know who we are? Chuck asked.
Thad didn't even acknowledge him. He picked up a hank of rope hanging from a large nail driven into a pole on the far side of the barn. As Thad headed back out, Chuck said,
Hey, fucker, untie me. You'll untie me if you know what's good for you.
The black man never showed anything to indicate he had heard and continued outside. Marty started to come around after the black man went outside.
Marty! Hey, Marty! Chuck whispered.
Marty raised his head and said,
Chuck? Is that you?
Yeah, it's me.
Where are we? What happened?
Last thing I remember was a truck coming at us.
Can you move? I'm tied tight and can't move a damn muscle.
Marty tried to move his arms, hands, and legs, but he was trussed up tight as well.
No, man, I can't move shit. The fuck are we?
The black guy stepped through the door again. Marty said,
What the fuck, man? The fuck are you doing?
Chuck looked over at Marty. He didn't know what was going on, but Marty's reaction scared him. He said,
Dude, the fuck is wrong with you?
Before Marty could say anything, the guy stepped up behind Chuck and wrapped his forearm around his neck. Chuck tried to drive his chin down, but Thad was too strong.
What do you want, you big black...
The man applied more pressure to his neck, and he was out. Marty went apeshit.
The fuck, man? What are you doing? What do you want?
He screamed. The black guy picked Chuck up, still tied to the chair, and carried him out of the barn. Marty's imagination ran wild as to what was happening outside, and what was surely about to happen to him. He began to cry and called out, begging for his life, asking what he wanted, and shouting threats. It felt like an eternity to Marty as he sat tied in the chair, but soon the black man came back through the door. Marty started to bounce up and down in his chair, and spittle flew out of his mouth as he cried and pleaded. The man never said a word, and simply carried him, chair and all, outside. He set Marty down beside the fence, facing a pig pen. Marty could see Chuck, still in his chair, sitting in the middle of it. There were several large hogs and sows milling around the pen. A couple of them were checking Chuck out, pushing their big wet noses against him. Chuck came around as one large hog shoved his snout into his crotch.
"What the hell?"
Chuck cried out as he came to. He tried to rock in the chair, but there was nothing he could do. Both men were startled by the rumbling sound of a tractor starting up, off to the side of the pig pen. The two men looked over to see the big black man sitting on the tractor and looking back over his shoulder at them. Before they could say anything, the tractor lurched and started to inch forward. Chuck's arms were tied behind his back, and they started to rise. Pulled up by the rope running through a block on a large limb of the tree. The other end was connected to the three-point hitch of the tractor. When the tractor stopped, Chuck was completely off the ground, the chair still tied to him, and his arms pulled up over his head, dislocating both of his shoulders. The black guy climbed off the tractor and went into the pen. Chuck was screaming in pain, and this caused the pigs to squeal, adding to the racket. The black man drew a big knife and cut the chair off Chuck, then bent down and untied his boots and took them off, tossing them to the side. Chuck was in so much pain he could hardly speak. With the boots off, the man stood and looked at Chuck.
"You the one who killed my family?"
In a low, breathy voice, Chuck replied,
"Fuck you."
The answer came from Marty.
"He did. He shot them. I swear to God, I didn't do it."
The man looked back at Marty.
"Why?"
"We came back to the house. We knew you weren't going to go, and we were going to try and scare you. She shot at us, and he shot her."
Chuck was slowly spinning around from his rope. In a pain-filled voice, he said,
"You sorry fucker. You set him on fire."
Marty said,
"They were dead. He shot them both. They were already dead."
The man turned back to Chuck. He tilted his head to the side to look into his eyes.
"You kill my boy?"
Chuck tried to spit in his face. The man stepped back, a little of the sputum landing on his coat. He quickly stepped forward and landed a quick right-left combination to Chuck's ribs. The wind left him, and he could hardly get a breath. The man turned and walked back into the barn and came out with a small jar and a paintbrush, one of those cheap blonde bristled throwaway type brushes. Chuck couldn't see him as he came up. He opened the jar and dipped the brush in, and then, taking it out, he held it down to the pigs. One of them started to lick the bristles, and then another pushed in. The man pushed past the pigs to Chuck, dipping the brush again. He began to brush the stuff on Chuck's bare feet. Chuck could smell molasses. He tried to protest, but he was in too much pain. Marty was still in hysterics and shouted,
"What the fuck are you doing?"
The pigs could smell the sweet goo on the feet dangling just over their heads. The man went over to the tractor and took up the strain on the rope Chuck was hanging from. He pulled on the tag end of the line, and the half hitches came loose. He lowered Chuck down toward the pigs. Chuck tried to pick up his legs to keep his naked feet away from the snouts of the swine below him. The man hitched the rope off when Chuck's feet were just in reach of the pigs. Thad stood there, looking at the man. He said,
"What's your name?"
Chuck looked up and said,
"Chuck. Chuck Henry."
Thad said,
You killed my boy and wife, Chuck Henry. Now you're going to pay for both of them. He turned to the mailman. And you're next. Chuck yelled,
They weren't dead!
What?
They weren't dead when Marty set the fire.
Chuck groaned through clenched teeth. Thad turned and looked at the mailman, Marty, who began to babble incoherently. Thad did manage to make out.
He killed him. It was his idea.
Don't worry. You're next, Thad said to Marty. Thad turned back when he heard Chuck let out a little yelp. The pigs were nipping at his toes. When Chuck didn't push them away, they began to bite harder. Thad took the jar, pushing the swine out of the way with his knees, made his way over to the hanging man. He brushed the dark, sweet goo all over Chuck's feet and calves. The man began to cry.
Just kill me, you sick fuck, for crying out loud. Just fucking kill me.
Thad looked the man in the eyes.
Oh, I'm going to. But you said there was alive in the house when y'all set the fire. That means they suffered. Bad. So you're gonna suffer too.
Chuck began to whimper and cry. He tried to keep his feet from the pigs, but he simply couldn't hold them up that long. Every time he dropped them a little, one of those damn animals would hop up off its front feet to get at his, biting his toes. As time went on, his toes turned into a bloody mess, and Chuck began to howl in pain as the little appendages were ripped off and consumed by the swirling mass of pork below him. Thad stood and watched as the pig slowly chewed and tore at the bloody feet. The screams became louder. Chuck had found a renewed vigor from someplace, and his cries grew louder and louder. He begged Thad to kill him and cursed him, asking what kind of sick son of a bitch does something like this. Thad stepped over to the man, making his way through the writhing swine, and said,
You want to die?
In a low, whimpering voice, Chuck replied,
Yes. For the love of God, yes.
All right then, Thad replied.
Taking a step back, he flipped open the straight razor he had found on the bench in the shop. He had put it there to sharpen and forgotten about it till today. In one quick motion, Thad swung the blade at Chuck's stomach. The blade went through the skin, tissue, and muscle of Chuck's abdomen. Chuck let out a scream as the blade went through him, but that was nothing compared to what followed. Thad stepped back and punched Chuck just below his diaphragm. The force of the blow caused his lower GI, large and small intestines, to fall out in a large mass, trailing down his legs. Chuck looked on in horror as he felt the tugs. The hogs were tearing at his insides. He hung there watching in stark terror as a pig grabbed a mouthful of small intestines and ran to the other side of the pen, a streamer of the small wet vessel trailing it. He let out a scream, a wail the likes of which no one present had ever heard. Thad stood there watching as the pigs consumed the organs in a frenzy. Marty, still tied to his chair, began to scream,
Kill him! For fuck's sake, just kill him!
It didn't last too long. One of the hogs pulled on a piece of Chuck's innards and a blood vessel ruptured. Dark red blood began to pour down Chuck's legs. His face started to go pale. And after a couple of slight tremors ran through what was left of his body, Chuck died. The only way Thad could tell was that he had stopped crying out. The pigs were still at work, and his body still swung and twisted on the rope. Accepting that he was dead, Thad turned to look at Marty. Marty was sitting there with that wide-eyed, slack-jawed expression he'd had since he came around. Looking at Thad, he went into a fit, violently shaking and rocking the chair. He was screaming total nonsense with spittle flying from his mouth and tears in his eyes. Thad started toward him, and Marty managed to fall over onto his side. Entering the mouth of the creek, the boat came under fire from the west shore. Ted yelled out,
Contact left!
And opened up with the saw he still held. Sarge joined in with his saw, and Mike set down his M4 and picked up the .203 that Doc had and started lobbing high explosive rounds at the muzzle flashes. The sudden, overwhelming response quickly silenced the two men firing at the boat. Doc turned the boat toward the shack. When they arrived, Sarge launched himself out as it came up to the little dock and began shouting orders out to the guys as they secured the boat. He wanted all the radios packed up in the cases, the solar panels down, and the ammo secured. They needed to move everything they could get to the truck as fast as possible. The boot was surely about to come down. To get to the truck, they had to hump a little more, that 300 yards through the swamp. They got everything packed, hauled to the truck, and loaded up. Things went so well that they had time to go back to the nice-to-have pile and pack that stuff up as well. The last thing they did was to booby-trap the shack. One corner of a piece of plywood was pried from the floor, and a pressure switch, sacrificed from one of the weapon lights, was placed under it. Ted adjusted the plywood until the circuit was open, wired it into a 9-volt battery, and connected it to a claymore. He ran another wire under the floor to the kitchen area, and a claymore was hidden behind the propane tank for the stove. That wire was then connected to the blasting cap of the claymore, creating a daisy chain charge. Another claymore was rigged to one of the boats outside. A piece of the inner braid of a section of 550 cord was pulled out and tied around the speedometer pickup tube on the stern on Sarge's boat. The string was run over to the dock and connected to a small piece of wood that was holding a clothespin open. The clothespin had the stripped wire from the positive side of the circuit from another 9-volt battery wrapped around it, so that when the boat was moved, the string would pull the piece of wood out, closing the circuit. This claymore was suspended under the dock with an additional 1-pound block of C4 pressed to its face. With the welcoming goodies set, Sarge and Ted headed for the truck for the last time. Doc and Mike were already there on watch. As they came out of the swamp, Sarge asked that one of them get on the military radio, the green gear, and try to make contact with their army contacts. He wanted them to know what had gone down, and also find out if there was a safe place to run to. Mike turned the radio on as soon as he got in the truck. He put the headphones on and started to tune the radio, and as soon as he was on the proper station, he heard, "Calling Swamp Rat." He sat and listened for a minute, and heard the full transmission when it was repeated. "Clementine calling Swamp Rat."
"This is Swamp Rat. Go ahead, Clementine, break," Mike said.
"Swamp Rat, what's your situation, break?"
"Swamp Rat is E&Eing out of our AO, break."
"Roger, are you in contact, break?"
"Negative, Clementine. We broke contact and are looking for a new home, break."
"Swamp Rat, are you feet wet or dry, break?"
"Swamp Rat is feet dry and mobile, break."
"Swamp Rat, you need to move toward Dallas. Op 4 Reaction Force is en route to your location via Serpent. You need to exfil immediately.
How copy, break?"
"Roger, Clementine, I copy. Heading for Dallas. Op 4 Reaction Force en route via Serpent. Does Op 4 have air assets committed, break?"
Mike handed Doc their map case and said, "Find Dallas."
"Unknown, Swamp Rat. Assume assets are in play. Notify Clementine when you reach Dallas. Clementine out."
"Roger, Swamp Rat, out."
Mike thumped the cab of the truck. Sarge looked back, and Mike leaned around so he could hear him. "Clementine says there's a reaction force coming down the river. They want us to head for Dallas."
"Where the fuck's Dallas?" Sarge asked.
"I don't know. Doc is looking for it on the map."
"Give me the fucking map."
Mike turned back to Doc. "Find it?"
"Not yet."
"The old man wants the map." Doc handed it over, and Mike passed it to Sarge, who immediately started scanning the map and the various rally points that were marked on it.
Chapter 20. I was sitting in the Suburban when Little Bit came trotting out of the house. She was carrying a little white plastic case with a red cross in the front of it. When she climbed up into the truck, I asked her, "What's that for?"
"It's my first aid kit. We might need it."
I just shook my head at her. I sure wished a first aid kit would help Lance.
I drove out the drive and made a left at the gate. As I passed the raider I had shot, she stood up in her seat to look and said, "Is that him?" "No, that's not him. That's one of the bad guys." She turned and sat back down in her seat without saying anything more, and we drove to the barricade. I backed up to where Lance was lying. Mark and Rick were still there, as well as a couple of other people from the neighborhood. Mark came around to my side as I got out. "Seen any others?" I asked. "There were a couple of people way down the road, but they didn't come up here. Can you help me load him up?"